presentation. Nah, thanks. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. Except that my iPad is failing me. I'm not able to get my information. If you have a copy, it's a very simple document, and then I'm trying to get it's not coming out. And it's my opposite. Okay, that is a brief background, although I believe that you are conversant as to the law society of South Africa that is. The law society of South Africa is composed of attorneys in the entire republic. There are six constituent members, where we got members from what's known as the Cape Law Society, the Law Society of Northern Provinces, which comprises of attorneys from Limpopo Province, Mpumalanga, Gauteng in Northwest. Then we have the KwaZulu-Natal Law Society, the Law Society of the Free State. We do have the National Association of Democratic Lawyers, popularly known as NADEL, and the Black Lawyers Association, BLA. Now, obviously, members of NADEL and BLA are members of this provincial law society, but for historical reasons, and with the view of striking the balance, there is such an agreement that it constitute, it be constituted by those six constituent members. In terms of practicing attorneys in the country, it's around 20,000, with around 5,000 candidate attorneys. Now, we take this opportunity to thank the ad hoc committee of the National Council of Provinces. You will have noted that that's basically the first remark which we gave, that then we are very much grateful that given the magnitude and seriousness of this bill, you saw the need of engaging with members of the public and civil society at large. As you have noted, I believe that our submission is one which is less longer, possibly, in comparison to the volume with which you have been dealing with. Of cardinal importance is the recognition which we do have that there is a need to move away from the past and move into the future. Central to that is a question of how do we move into the future, and then this opportunity just presents an opportunity for making a presentation or a contribution on how we think the bill should or could have been structured. You should have noted that we are of the submission that it could have been done differently, in the sense that its focal point, given the essence of its objective, should have likely has been focused on the security cluster. But what we are seeing in the document as it stands is that there has been a bringing in of various, you know, government institutions and bestowing them with the power of classifying. It could have constituted justice to the bill had it been focused, you know, on the security cluster, and then we would be able, you know, to give a more meaningful contribution to it than in its stated form. Nonetheless, one of the reasons why we say that is that it appears to be having an erosion on the intelligent piece of legislation which came after the new dispensation, the prior. Obviously, there are sentiments which have already been expressed to the effect that it intrudes into that particular legislation in many ways than one. We don't actually understand as to what motivated the inclusion of parastatals as well as municipalities, and equally delegating power to those particular entities to do classification. I ponder and ask, what kind of classified information does an institution like a municipality under a municipal manager, what is it which a municipal manager has to classify? Can't a municipal manager, as well as the chief executive officers in the various parastatals, can't their issues be dealt with within PAIA? Does that particular legislation not adequately address the issues which they normally deal with? You see, that particular inclusion of those kinds of entities may be largely contributing in the diversion which is taking place when it comes to identifying the core of the need for the enactment of this particular legislation, which is dealing with the issues of national security. So it is our considered submission that the prior legislation does adequately address the non-security related clusters of government. The legislation deals amply and adequately with the protection of information, and there are clear processes which have been set out on how the issue of access to information may be obtained. But the clouding in putting these other factors into a security-related legislation has that negative effect, you know, of too much talk, you know, being talk being hinged upon the issues of corruption and things like that. But has the legislation been put in the way which, and then we submit, the issues could have been narrowed and the centrality of our argument would be more deeper than it is now. Now, obviously, flowing from that, our submission is that the application of this legislation, if it were to deal exclusively with intelligence-related matters within the cluster under which the intelligence falls, it would have narrowed down the issues, because the question now is, what do we do with the overlap in terms of provisions which are there in PAIA? Are we going to render them obsolete in light of the culmination and coming into being of this particular bill? And what do we say about the onerous duty which is being placed from the information accessing point of view when we look at the provisions of the bill vis-a-vis what we have in PAIA? And this particular question is more relevant with respect to the parastatals as well as municipal managers, unless we are convinced somehow that municipal managers as well as the chief executive officers of various parastatals, in the ordinary course of their duties, there may be circumstances which warrant that there be classified information by them. I don't want to boggle you down, you know, into the merits and demerits of bestowing them with those powers of classification, because obviously and inextricably there is a net effect which might culminate in the unnecessary clogging of court roles, because the suspicion of fear of corruption, whether placed or misplaced, will always be there. So if that delineation were to be appreciated, I think that then we would have done more justice than it basically appears, because it's more a question of cluttering and bringing in together the entire administration through various departments and creating some form of delegated authority to various functionaries and bestowing them with the powers to classify as well as declassify, and equally creating a problem with respect to, from the court perspective, it will just be cloaking the court, you know, and calling upon them to question things from a security perspective, including those which do not fall under the security perspective. Obviously, we do make some submissions here with respect to the contemplated sentences, that we submit that the reduction of maximum sentences, we are not necessarily playing down the gravity or seriousness of the security of the nation. But having said that, the question is whether the infractions are of such a magnitude such that a preemptive provision up to the number of years made is a warranted one in the circumstances. Now, when we deal with the proposal for the elimination of minimum sentences, we make that particular submission informed by the background that there is a need for merit assessment when it comes to each and every case. Like it was pointed out by some of those who made the submissions before, that someone might be in possession of the information intentionally, negligently, or ignorantly. The scale of sentencing, if that's the way to go, can never be equated. It would not constitute justice for someone who has intentionally committed the criminal offense to someone whom the evidence clearly points out that he or she was just ignorant, and you mete out the similar penalty given that there are prescriptions as to sentence. So each case has to be weighed according to its merit, and some element of discretion after weighing the facts and the circumstances should be a factor which is taken into account. I've already stated, inasmuch as we are not alive to the submissions which have been made by various stakeholders whom you have invited, including those through whom you went through the length and the breadth of the country, I am not certain as to whether or not there is any representation which has been made with respect to separating this particular bill and putting a focal point on the security-related aspect and leaving out the other aspects to the legislation which is applicable, which we submit that it adequately addresses the issues, because what we are seeing is a duplication of roads, one of them appearing to be, for lack of better words, more draconian than the former one. So, in a nutshell, I think that captures the essence of our submission.
Thank you, Mr. Mabunda. Is there something from Ms. Chancellor, or should I? Okay. Honorable members, Honorable Nsimande.
Chairperson, I hope I captured the in the submission the concern around the classification, the inclusion of the other organs of state, municipalities, parastatals, because in section 3, chapter 7, the of the bill, it makes separation, and I think it's a matter that from the presentation this morning, that the clarity between the protected information and the classified information, it gets crossed over from time to time. So I would like to ask, is that the understanding that this clause 3 of the bill as it stands, Chair, is not allowing, well, is not talking to, is not allowing the separation of classified information by the head of state, by the head of organs, and I think it talks about around 3 organs of state that classified sensitive, confidential, and top secret information, unless extended by the minister. The third option is that unless a good cause shows. So I'm not too sure in terms of this submission, Chair, whether it's trying to clarify further that or is concerned about the distrust and those conditions contained in subsection 3. So I would like more clarity on that one, Chair, because as I understand it, is that the valuable information is only protected unless in that third option, where there is a good cause shown that that it may be classified with justification, I guess, Chair. So if we could get clarification on that one, then with regard to the what would is the penalty. There is also a concern in the submission around the penalties. I would like clarity, Chair, whether the Law Society, in its understanding of the current practices of, I think it's in the Constitution, if I remember correctly, where courts have a reserved privilege of applying their judgments into circumstances of under which offences have been committed, and have even convictions being handled. That the courts, and it's been a practice that the courts not necessarily apply or bound or prescribed to be bound and obliged to implement sentences as prescribed by the law. So there are conditions and circumstances and factors that allow courts to decide whether to give the sentences as such as prescribed or less or even more. So I'm saying as the drafting now as it stands, the Law Society, what is it that concerns them? Because is this clause of sentencing and penalties, they affect that privilege that the courts have in terms of the Constitution. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Mr. Mandi. Any other member?
Thank you very much, Chair. No, it's also in line, Chair, with Louis' question. I want clarity on this issue of municipalities. Are you saying that this will pose a danger for then the municipal manager or whoever, because the bill is talking about municipal manager, will then be that powerful person to hide all information or decide
to declassify or classify any information that we deem it is secret information. Thanks.
Thank you. If that is all, oh, Honorable Magdalena?
No, no, Chair, I just wanted to clarify one thing, because I'm not sure if you've heard the bill, because this bill is not talking about the local government structures or other institutions that you have. If you read the bill, it does not indicate that situation, yeah, including municipal managers.
Actually, if I heard you correctly, you were saying that we are closing it by the inclusion of municipalities and CEO parastatals, or CEOs of parastatals, if I got you correctly, if not in coaching. And that worries me because I haven't seen that. So maybe if you can assist us to be clarified on those issues of the inclusion of the respect, you can now respond.
Just bear with me. I have to now look at the relevant section. I thought that, and then we are possibly together, and the question would not arise. No, I'm fine. I've been able to get it. Shouldn't I start with that latter question? Can we go to the definition under head of an organ of state? That would be number B. It says that the head of an organ of the state, in case of a municipality, will be the municipal manager as appointed in terms of section 82 of the Local Government Municipal Act 1988, which is Act 45, number 117 of 1998, or the person who is acting as such. Now, what I'm saying is, there are provisions in this Act where there is delegated function. Let's understand it that the security minister is the one on whom the powers are vested. Now, there is a delegated function, delegation of power, rather, to municipal managers, chief executive officers of parastatals. I'm not missing the point here. There are express provisions which are saying that those people do have the power to classify and declassify. Now I return to my point that my humble submission, I'm not convinced that I am misreading the Act. My humble submission, given that particular understanding, is that this, with that understanding, may be construed to imply that the giving of powers in terms of creating the veil of secrets is being perpetuated to, it tilts down from security related cluster to institutions which prima facie have absolutely nothing to do with security related issues. That's my point. And my submission to the effect that If we did not mix the two, and understanding the gravity and seriousness of protecting the information of security in the country, not mix it with power, delegated powers being given by the minister to people like municipal managers, as well as these chief executive officers of various parastatals. That's my point, that it would do justice, you know, for the country at large to zoom into the security legislation, looking at it purely from a security point of view. When we deal with protected information, when we deal with classified information, then we would be knowing that we are dealing with the heart of the issue, which is captured in the object of this particular legislation. Now, I don't think that as it stands, it does constitute justice. That perception which I'm talking about becomes more abound when it comes to the point of giving this delegated power to institutions which I believe have absolutely nothing to do with security-related issues. I hope in the course of my response, the point of all good cause shown, which the honorable member Zimande pointed out to, I was not intending to deal with it, but you mentioning it, obviously, it would not be a comfortable provision to have. Now that you mention it, it would not be a comfortable provision to have, because what does it do? It just gives unfettered power through gazetting to the minister on issues of security, if that's what we're dealing with. Why those powers, in our view, should be parliamentary legislative powers. The question on sentences and practices. You are very correct. If that's where you were driving me to, the submission which I was making is aligned to what you call the inherent jurisdiction of the court. You see, if we are having legislations like prescribed minimum sentences, which normally and likely comes about as a result of public outcry, and there end up being some form of a capitulation from the legislature as a result of the outcry, that in itself does have a problem. Because when circumstances are different, and after you have weighed the facts, the evidence, holistically and objectively, you should retain those inherent powers which will cause you to be guided by what was before you, in order to mete out a sentence at the end of the day, if ever a sentence is to be meted out. Like, without necessarily repeating myself, Chair, the point which I indicated about this person who possesses the information intentionally, negligently, and by ignorance, given that the offense has indeed been committed, there's a minimum sentence which applies equally to all. That in itself will not constitute justice. I do, of course, have a number of issues, but then I think it's fair for us perhaps to limit ourselves to the submissions which we have put forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chancellor. Is that a follow-up on Honourable Zimani? Okay.
I'm trying to understand the in clause 3 that I raised. I was not making an emphasis only on the option of the minimum. I'm trying to deduce what, or to get specific on what the Law Society is saying. Is the Law Society saying that this bill should not deal with protection of valuable information? Because that definition that is highlighted with municipality is in terms, because the bill deals with two types of information, if I may put it that way, or two categories. One which is the valuable, the protected valuable information, and classified top secret, sensitive, and confidential information. So I'm saying that in terms of that understanding, in terms of what the Law Society is saying here, as its submission, is that the valuable, the protected valuable information must not be part of the bill. That's the clarity that I'm trying to seek. And then I heard, though, also on the penalties, whether they are saying that we must remove we must remove minimum sentences. Is that what their position is, or they feel that the existence of these minimum sentences really affect the inherent, as you said, inherent jurisdictions of the court in looking at circumstances of lessening or maximizing beyond minimum the sentences that would be handed out on convictions on commissions of offences of disclosing the information illegally. Thank you, Chair.
I hope I understood you correctly, Honourable Member, that you are confining your question to the issue of these municipalities and parastatals insofar as what you call protected valuable information is concerned. Will I be answering you correctly if I contextualize my question around that? Correct, okay. The answer is very simple when it comes to municipalities and parastatals. What kind of protected, valuable information is being envisaged within those kind of institutions? It's basically, it does not come to mind for me as to what protected, valuable information is expected to be protected from those particular institutions, setting aside the security clusters without delving into their merits themselves, but purely on the municipalities as well as the parastatals. What kind of protected valuable information do they have? Which information may equally be inaccessible from a payer point of view? In other words, what kind of information will those institutions have if ever we are to invoke the provisions of payer? There is such a problem. I strongly submit that this delineation would have been an imperative, because what has happened in this piece of B, repeating myself once more, is that we look at various relevant departments within the entire administration, then the Minister of Intelligence delegates power to various functionaries and bestowing them with the inherent power to classify, declassify, under whatever guise, protected valuable information or any other class beyond that. It just doesn't feature well. And then the other thing, what do we do with PIA? I would say that the protection of information in terms of PIA should now be rendered nugatory or ineffective or obsolete or of no force or effect, or the two are going to run concurrently. If I feel that PIA can do justice for me as a member of public in terms of accessing that, I can use PIA and ignore this bill, or how are they going to run? Because it's basically constituting an erosion on the powers of PIA insofar as the information is concerned. I am drawing the distinction, you know, between the security aspect, which we are of course mindful of, versus what is being done, because this is just an amalgamation of legislation which has an effect of undermining the prior legislation as it stands. And it is not friendly to members of the public from the access to information point of view. But I don't want to get there.
Well, Chair,
I think if I'm listening very well here, see, the point that Honorable Louis was trying to make was that, are you suggesting that in a situation where there is contradiction between PIA and this one, those should be separated to avoid the duplication that you're talking about? Is the point that you're trying to make? Because, quite frankly, I'm sure you also agree that not all parastatals falls under that definition that you are putting, because some of the parastatals in the country, their role goes along the line of national security. We can make examples of such, some of those particular but I'm sure you agree. I'm not sure which municipalities, but we can verify the drafters of the bill, but I'm trying to think of big metros like Johannesburg, for example. We can't say for certain that they might not have anything that to do with national security in their operation. In a municipality that is as small as Mwathe, you can raise such questions. But in Metro, I think we, but it's something that we have to verify. We can check with the drafters of the law because some of the things might have been influenced by certain experiences. But I just wanted just to amplify the point that Honorable Nzimande was making, because I think the presenter missed it there. So we seem to be in agreement with the nodding of the head there, I hope.
Let's not say he missed it. He actually is talking about the definition, head of an organ of state, and the what he is bringing is the delegating part by the minister.
No. That one, the point I was making, that Honorable Liu was saying, is he correct then to understand him to say where there is duplication or contradiction or what appears to be a contrast between the two, being Pyria and what? Because the question that has been coming up from the morning was that if this area A is sufficiently covered in Pyria, why do you then still refer to it in this B in a manner different from what is in Pyria? Because other presenters, some and them, make the same submission. So the question was, are you saying we should separate the two? Which, if I'm listening well, that's what the law society is saying. Otherwise, the other one will rubbish the other and give people option to say, no, I'm concentrated on this act and I'll come here on this one.
Law society, assist us. I know you are a legal people. You will come with you know, all that legal freedom. Layman's language. Let's understand.
Thank you, Chair. In simpler terms, the part which, and then I would agree with the honourable member last point, is when he talks about some municipality at the city or Kukune or Kwamhlabolingana. What kind of classified information, you know, do they have? But I would go beyond and include the Cape Metro and other metros, Joburg, Tshwane, Thekwini, and the Eastern metro in the East Rand in Johannesburg. I'll include all of them and say that the law of general application should apply across with them. I'll tell you why the law of general application should apply. There remains checks and balances, you see. There is no absolute right of classification. If a point, even if there's such a classification, that can and should still be put to test or scrutiny by the court of law. When I read the provisions of the bill here, I did note that, and then if you are supposed to hand over the documents which you deem classified, because there are challenges on those documents, there is a further onerous task on the court on how that information has to be protected until such time that a pronouncement on the merit or demerit of that particular matter is concerned. Because one looks at this whole issue in a twofold way. One, there is an issue of criminal sanction, but it does not only end up in the criminalizing part. The question which comes to mind is whether you can be barred from invoking the provisions of access to information to have access to what we call classified information. So,
Honorable Chan is so to speak. Okay, Honorable.
Not Chair, I hear that they are agreeing. But you see, when you're writing a law, you don't take its municipality. No matter if it's a small municipality or what, if the law is saying municipality, a municipal manager, it's municipal manager. If this, whether it's metro or whatever, all of them are stealing and all of them must be put under one law. And that's it. You can't say the CGC is there's no money, and then at metro there's no such a thing.
Honorable Bloom, and so what? Thank you very much.
may I be allowed to respond? The Honorable Bloom was not listening.
No, let's leave it. Honorable Bloom.
I'm saying precisely what you are saying.
Well, Mabunda, don't get into it. I know what is happening on that table. You don't even have to clarify. Yeah, no, we are used to that. Honorable members, no, you don't have to. we know you very well. Honorable members, Honorable Mabunda.
Sure. I think it is important that Honorable Blue must call to order and be commanded to withdraw the word that says all municipalities, there's a blanket theft.
Oh, did he say
yes,
that?
Yes, he said all of them are stealing. And I think it is only fair that for the purpose of the integrity of the committee and the work that we are dealing with here, we should avoid this kind of statement.
Honorable Bloom, I didn't hear that.
I will clarify that point.
No, I don't need any clarification at this stage. If you really said that all municipalities are stealing, can we withdraw that for the sake of...
I want to clarify.
You want to...
I say I want to clarify, but you are forcing me to know.
Honorable Bloom, this is an official meeting, and we are not joking in this meeting. So if you are going to say all municipalities are stealing, really, I cannot take that, and I don't need any clarification for you having said that. If you didn't say it, it's okay, you didn't say it. But if you said it, you need to withdraw it. I'm not going to allow clarification. We are not in a kangaroo type of meeting. Thank you. Are you going to do that before we continue? Or should we take it as a statement that it is not the committee that says that, but it is your own, as Honorable Bloom, saying all the municipalities are safe? Because we are going to disown that. It is not our what comes from this committee. And I believe that as we are seated here, we represent an ad hoc committee. Can I have a withdrawal for the sake of this?
Let me explain. But you are not giving me chance.
I'm not going to give you a chance to explain what you have said. Honorable Bloom, those members and everybody in here, you must know that what Honorable Bloom is saying is not the views of this committee, but it is what he thinks of all the municipalities. So in cases of anything that needs to be questioned, it must not be on the committee, but be on an individual as Mr. Bloom.
That's fine.
Thank you. We continue. Thank you very much, Mr. Mabunda and Ms. Chancellor. Thank you for your explaining your contribution. Allow the chairperson to come back.
Thanks.
Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Borota, for having allowed me to deal with all these other things. Honorable members, can we get to the
last presentation by 238 Corruption Watch. And maybe just to make the point, I think we must put it on record. We must put it on record. We are a multi-party committee. And we will have an opportunity as political parties to make our own observations, our own inputs, and whatever. Whether they be destructive, whether they be constructive, whether they be taking us forward or taking us backwards or making us to stop. But it is quite important that for the purpose of this exercise, that we apply to our best, to the best of our ability, caution and respect for the process. So in our, in whatever way that as political parties sometimes we get tempted to fall into a trap of wanting to play politics because we want to be seen to be playing politics, just hold it. The time will come. Because I guess all other political parties would do have some responses to some comments made, especially those reckless ones. But of course, we, like the Honorable Borota said, we unconditionally as a committee distance ourselves from a statement, from a sweeping statement, and a highly misdirected statement, way off the presentation. We unequivocally distance ourselves from that as a committee. Corruption Watch, here. Yeah?
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. And it must,
it's not Mary Ann Yabati, as you see.
Okay. I thought maybe it was Miss President.
My name is David Lewis, and I'm the director of Corruption Watch.
David?
Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to make this submission to the committee. We are only very recently formed, and in fact were formed slightly before the deadline for written submissions to the committee. So we didn't make a written submission and were invited to make an oral submission for which we're very grateful. We take it as a signal that the committee is as concerned about corruption as we are, as actors on the show. But nothing gets past this parliament that would inhibit our ability or anybody's ability to fight against corruption. I should explain that Corruption Watch is an independent NGO. It was set up largely at the initiative of the Kasatu office bearers, but is an independent institution with its own independent board of directors and independently funded of any particular interest. But I think it certainly was set up as Kasatu's initiative and enjoys, I think, fairly widespread civil society backing. So unlike the other submissions made here and the other institutions that have been submitting to this process, we aren't veterans of the protracted process of discussion that has accompanied the passage of this bill. And my remarks are going to be at a fairly high level of generality, and they're going to come from the perspective of a group that has been set up, dedicated to participating in combating corruption, and this is an objective, if you like, that is shared across the spectrum. Certainly, leading members of the executive are on record as expressing the gravity of corruption in South Africa and their determination to fight it. Deputy President Botlanthe is on record describing corruption as after racism, the most serious malady staring humanity in the face today. At our launch, the Minister of Justice, Mr. Jeff Radebe, described corruption as a serious challenge facing our democratic transformation. So we're aware, and you're aware, no doubt share those views, that you would not want to do anything, you would not want anything to come out of this house that that made it more difficult to combat what is already a very difficult social disease. That we're aware, and we're pleased to see that there is a provision in the bill that criminalizes the classification of information for the purpose of hiding corruption. However, this latter provision notwithstanding, it remains our firm view that this bill, if passed in its present form, will indeed seriously impede the fight against corruption. And for that reason, we feel fairly confident that the bill will not be passed in its present form. So we're going to make our submissions from the perspective of a non-governmental organization that is engaged in fighting corruption. And both of these elements of our perspective, I think, have to be treated with due seriousness. As for the element that is about our objective to combat corruption, it's our contention that the fight of against corruption can't be meaningfully separated from the fight against can't be separated from the imperative to guard our national security. We're going to further contend that corruption represents a greater threat to South Africa's public interest than do the threats to national security from which the bill seeks to protect us. Of course, corruption within the security apparatuses themselves not only stymies efforts to combat corruption across the board, but it constitutes a direct attack on our national security. We want equally to emphasize our NGO status. We accept that corruption can't be combated without the powers, resources, and remedies available to the criminal justice system. However, corruption, particularly on the scale of corruption that one sees in South Africa at the moment, can't be conquered through law enforcement alone. Corruption is a social problem where stealing from the public as opposed to an individual or a company is too often viewed as a victimless crime. However, I think, as we would all accept, this is precisely the opposite of the truth. Corruption generates massive social problems, in particular a significant diversion of resources from the public, and especially that part of the public who are dependent on public provision. Corruption has also led to a disturbing erosion of trust between the public on the one hand and elected representatives and public servants on the other hand. So that even when government and the legislature proposes measures that are clearly for the public good, it's increasingly treated with suspicion. What's in it for them is the first question that is almost invariably heard. So our view is that until the public speaks out, until civil society speaks out, until it tells its elected leaders and its public servants how commonly it experiences corruption and who corruption's victims are, these crimes against the public will not be treated with sufficient seriousness, and the perpetrators will not be treated like the common criminals that they are. So a public that both informs and is informed is central to our mission and is central to harnessing the public in the fight against corruption. That's the task that I'll elaborate in a moment that we've set for ourselves, and that's why we're here today. I want to make two points clear from the outset. The first is that we take no comfort from assurances that it is not the intention of either the executive or the legislature that this bill should impede the fight against corruption. We believe that the bill has to be assessed objectively on its terms. If on an objective assessment it is found that there are provisions in the bill that are capable of impeding the flow of information, that is the principal weapon in the fight against corruption, then the offending provision should go, whatever the intentions of the legislature or whatever the intentions of the executive are in this regard. The increasing incidences of serious corruption, in particular at the second and third tiers of government, is ample evidence that there are sufficient individuals who are custodians of large public resources who will be only too willing to take advantage of any legislative provision, whatever its intention, that enhances their efforts to loot public resources, not least by preventing those who have knowledge of their criminal conduct from reporting them. Zero tolerance against corruption means that nothing can be left to chance, and that this has to expressly include closing any loophole in our legislative framework that provides even the slightest opportunity to commit and to get away with acts of corruption. So that's the first point that we want to make at the outset. The second is that we don't dispute the necessity for secrecy in the handling of information that represents a threat from both internal and external sources to the national security of the republic. We understand a threat to national security to mean a threat to the territorial integrity of the republic, to its constitutional order, and to the safety and security of those who live in it. Our national security is under no imminent or even foreseeable threat from armed movements, internal or external. The clear and present dangers already confronting us come from poverty and inequality, unemployment and corruption. These factors are already clearly the root cause of significant social unrest. And there can be no gainsaying that corruption is eating away at the innards of our most important institutions and is a direct contributor to increasing inequality and to persistently high levels of poverty. Nor can it be denied that corruption is rife in the very heart of the institutions responsible for defending our national security. The police, the very home guard that must deal with the threat to national security, the institution that is meant to secure the safety of those who live in South Africa, is a hotbed of corruption. In the last week or two, we have, for example, received a report from an informant alleging that in one important regional policing division, he alleges nepotism in appointments made without advertisement, the falsification of statistics, the abuse of police resources for private gain, the awarding by the officer in charge of supply chain management in the region of contracts worth millions to a close family member. Our informant, moreover, alleges that this conduct has been reported to the Internal Complaints Directorate, who confirmed the allegations, and to the National Commissioner, but nothing has been done about it. At the other end of the policing spectrum, we have received hundreds of reports from all corners of the country of venal traffic police, in many ways the frontline police people, the policemen and women who the public deal with in a most direct way, and their role in corruption is alleged. So what can we as a civil society organization do about corruption in the police and in the other security apparatuses? We can do a number of things, but principally what we are doing is we are providing a platform for the public to openly report their experiences, the better to encourage others to report their experiences. We are providing platforms to enable the public to express their opinions, the better to encourage others to give theirs. And we are providing a platform that enables the public to speak to those in authority. The way those in our law enforcement authorities who are corrupt, through these platforms, will know that the public are onto them and that the public despise them. And those who are honest will know that the public supports them. and the elected representatives who are charged with exercising oversight of the police will know that the public is watching how they exercise their oversight, it is judging them, and that if necessary, the public will react. There is every likelihood that information pertaining to corruption in the police and other parts of the security apparatus, because we have also received reports alleging corruption in the SANDF, for example, there's every likelihood that this sort of information will fall foul of the legislation contemplated here, despite the fact that combating corruption in these organizations will undoubtedly strengthen rather than compromise our national security. We will, in the immediate future, in the next couple of weeks, be releasing a report on the Johannesburg Metropolitan Police Department, and we have a real and reasonable apprehension that this report would not see the light of day had the legislation contemplated in the bill already been in place. Of course, corruption is not only flourishing in the police and the other security apparatuses, it's flourishing in other key areas of public delivery. Small municipalities, and this is on the basis of over 1,000 reports that we've received in the 8 weeks of our existence. Small municipalities, the healthcare system and the education system have been the subject of many of the reports that we have received. There can be little doubt that poor delivery from these systems is at the root of increasing social tension. Now you may ask what this has to do with the bill, and I must repeat again that information is the key ingredient in fighting corruption, or corruption wherever it occurs. Even the most efficient, least corrupt police force in the world, and that would not begin to describe our own law enforcement authority, could not confront even a small proportion of corruption. They can go for the very big fish who reap the really large rewards from these multiple acts of corruption, or those who, for a number of reasons, choose not to see corruption. To do that, the police also need information. It can be clandestine information, but it also needs people who are willing to speak up and bear witness, sometimes in an open court. But to get at these multiple acts of corruption, there is no doubt that sunlight is the most effective disinfectant. We need public witnesses, publicly told stories that isolate the venal public servant or the corrupt business person, that make them look over their shoulders all the time, as it makes a corrupt elected representative, or just the elected representative that has not stood up to corruption, worry about his or her prospects for re-election. And for this to happen, we need a public that is free to inform and to be informed. And this, we insist, must be a strong consideration that informs judgment about what is acceptable and not acceptable about the protection of state information. Our apprehension, and we'll elaborate this below, is that as a result of this bill and of the inflexible and punitive approach that it adopts towards an important class of state information, protection of state information rather than access to state information will be perceived as the default position of the South African information regime, and that this in turn will compromise efforts to combat corruption on a broad front, extending well beyond the security establishment at which we accept the bill is principally directed. We're going to make a few focused points. We've read, amongst others, the submissions of the Legal Resources Centre and the Open Democracy Advice Centre. We strongly endorse the views of the LRC on the constitutionality of the lack thereof of the intended legislation, as we do ODAC's arguments regarding the impact of the bill, if passed, would have on whistleblowing and its essential incompatibility with the constitutionally mandated Promotion of Access to Information Act, as well as to the Protected Disclosures Act. What we want to do in our submission, and it will be brief, is that we want to focus on the relationship of the provisions and policies underlying the bill to our constitutional values, to our foundational values. We want to look at the relationship of the bill to the Promotion of Access to Information Act, and we want to look at the relationship of the bill to whistleblowing. We have no pretense to make weighty legal pronouncements, nor do we draft alternative formulations. We're happy to defer to others better placed than us to do this. So our comment is at the level of values and at the level of the practical impact this bill will have, if enacted, will have on the free flow of information necessary to combat corruption. So to talk then first about our foundational values and the bill that is before this committee. The avowed purpose of the bill is the defense of national security. And national security, as I've said already, is characteristically thought to be compromised by conduct that threatens the territorial integrity of the Republic, its constitutional order, and the safety and security of those who live in it. This essentially negative definition of national security constitutes, but for the unfortunate addition of the, and I quote, exposure of economic, scientific, or technological secrets vital to the Republic. And I just want to pause here for a minute and say that, speaking personally, if there was any provision in this bill that I would be prepared to lie down in the road to oppose, it would be this. The addition of the exposure of economic, scientific, or technological secrets vital to the Republic is one of the criteria for classification. I can see that as a charter for abuse of this bill. What possible document in the arms deal could not be classified on this basis? I think it's the only part of the definition of national security in the bill that departs, although it's very wordy, but essentially the bill defines national security as a threat to territorial integrity, as a threat to our constitutional order, and as a threat to the safety and security of the people of South Africa. The only one that extends, the only clause that I can see that extends beyond that is a classification criteria based on economic, scientific, or technological secrets, and I think that it's a really egregious aspect of the bill. So axiomatically then, the only information, and this would be drawing from the bill, that I can understand that threatens South Africa's territorial integrity, its constitutional order, and the safety and security of its citizens, is only information that threatens those three elements. Back as I've said for the introduction of the positional clause, that should ever be the subject, that it should ever be subject to the sort of restrictions that are contemplated by the bill. Our constitution, however, provides a significantly wider and a positive cost to the meaning of national security. Section 198A of the constitution provides that, and I quote, national security must reflect the resolve of South Africans as individuals and as a nation, to live as equals, to live in peace and harmony, to be free from fear and want, and to seek a better life. So the Constitution effectively provides that national security is undermined by conduct that promotes inequality, disharmony, and fear. Corruption clearly promotes inequality. It is palpably at the root of growing disharmony, and it thrives in an environment where those who live in South Africa are fearful of the consequences of reporting and otherwise combating corruption. So it follows that legislation that causes the public to fear reporting corruption is at odds with our constitutional values. And if, in our short experience so far, we have learned nothing else, we have learned that South Africans not only fear, and with good reason, reporting corruption, that this fear will be exacerbated if this bill is passed into law. And I'll elaborate the basis for that conclusion in a moment. Indeed, the positive cost that the Constitution gives to the meaning of national security must, by virtue of its provenance, must, by virtue of where it comes from, as it were, trump the negative cost given by the bill. That is, should there be a conflict between suppressing information that on the one hand may undermine national security as defined in the bill, and that on the other hand may, through the dissemination of the same information, promote efforts to combat inequality, disharmony, and fear, which is the Constitution's definition of national security, the latter consideration, be it that they come from the Constitution, must trump the former. We should re-emphasize, again as I've already said, that there is no immediate or foreseeable threat to national security as defined in the bill. There is, on the other hand, a clear and present threat from the greater inequality and disharmony that is in no small part attributable to escalating levels of corruption, costing by some estimations over 25 billion rand annually. Now, the defenders of the bill will respond to this argument by insisting that the bill only seeks to restrict information that threatens national security as defined in the bill, that the bill will not restrict information that will promote the Constitution's vision of national security, and this includes information that will better enable the combating of corruption. In that case, we would recommend to the legislature to rename the bill for the protection of state information that pertains to national security, that the legislature will specifically exempt any information that could lead to criminal prosecution of the corrupt from its definition of classified information, and that government will initiate a major information and education campaign to accompany new legislation. This public service campaign would seek to encourage members of the public to report information pertaining to corruption, that will advise them where to report this information, and will assure them that the provisions of the legislation will not be used against anyone who reports corruption. It's our view, and I'm sure that it's your view, that it's the duty and principal function of legislatures to expand people's rights and not to take them away. So much about the relationship between the bill and our foundational constitutional values. What about the bill and the Promotion of Access to Information Act, PIA? PIA is a statute that I'm sure you've heard a number of times in these hearings, is constitutionally mandated to give expression to the Constitution's guarantee of the right of access, and I'm quoting from the Constitution here, the right of access to any information held by the state and any information held by another person, and that is required for the exercise or protection of any right. PIA is thus a critical elaboration of our Bill of Rights, and extreme care should be taken to ensure that it's not weakened by parallel legislative measures that also seek to legislate conditions of access to state information. We believe that this bill weakens PIA, and we respectively suggest that in this regard the committee give close attention to the submission of the Open Democracy Advice Centre. The truth is, and you heard this expressed more eloquently than I can by the Human Rights Commission, is that the state at all levels is not wont to give easy access to information. And this has already been borne out for us by our limited experience. We have, for example, attempted to gain access to the Manasseh report dealing with allegations of corruption and mismanagement in Ekurhuleni. This has been refused on the grounds that the persons cited in the report must be accorded the right to be heard, despite the fact that all of these persons will inevitably have been heard in the process of compiling the report, and that should these persons be indicted, the court will naturally accord them the right to be heard again. So I can't understand this minute attention to the Audi Alterum Partem rule. It sounds to me like, frankly, like an abuse. And this restrictive attitude to the release of information, even information that has no bearing on the standard definition of national security, and the denial of which certainly restricts information pertinent to combating corruption,
should speak volumes to those who believe the legislation currently contemplated will not be used or abused to further restrict access to information. I should say that the incredibly easy result of people in both the public sector and the private sector to a very outdated version of the sub judice rule, which allegedly prevents them from saying anything about anything while something is going through the long legal processes, and the very easy resort to the principle that everyone is innocent until proved guilty means that you can't say anything about somebody whose public conduct sounds dodgy because they've not been found guilty. Seems to me, you know, once again an abuse, and the sort of abuse that the potential for which is written into this bill in a very powerful way. So we've now commenced, having been denied access to the Manasse report, and having been denied access to the report prepared by the SIU on the Gauteng healthcare sector, which is also riddled with corruption. So we've now commenced an application in terms of PIA for access to the Manasse report. Now this is undoubtedly going to prove a long and costly role. Both of these PIA applications. By all accounts of which we are aware, PIA has not proved particularly friendly to those persons or institutions wishing to gain access to information, particularly where the latter do not have access to the resources necessary to support lengthy litigation. And even where the claimant is able to litigate and to triumph, the information eventually released after the long legal process is significantly devalued by the sheer length of time required to exhaust the legal process. However, the fact is that PIA is what we have, and we should be thinking of strengthening it, and in particular easing the path and lowering the cost of utilising its provisions. We should certainly, as we've already stated, be guarding against any parallel legislative action that weakens PIA. The introduction of a new highly restrictive access to information regime, one that is focused not only on restricting information and punishing both those responsible for its dissemination and those to whom it is disseminated, is bound to damage the existing regime, which based on PIA is rooted in the premise, a premise that is enshrined in our constitution, that the South African public should be entitled to information in the hands of their state, and I underline their state. We agree with the principle enunciated by the Carter Center that information belongs to the people. Governments simply hold information in their name. There are a wide range of exemptions in PIA. If the provisions of PIA are permitting access to information that is threatening our national security, that is, to repeat ourselves, that is threatening the territorial integrity of the Republic, that is threatening its constitutional order and the safety and security of the public, if PIA is allowing for access to information of that sort, then the first best response, surely, is to revisit and strengthen the exemptions in PIA. It is not to set up an alternative regime that, with respect to an important class of information, is premised on an approach that is directly contradictory to the statute that expressly gives provision to the provisions and entire tenor of our constitution. We should add here too that we are unaware of any instance in which the condition for access under the provisions of PIA has permitted the release of information that has jeopardized national security, however national security is defined. By the same token, if we are inclined to suspect, if, as we are inclined to suspect, the bill is partly born out of the understandable frustration on the part of our security agencies at the state's inability to keep its legitimate secrets out of the public eye, then again, surely the first best measure is to strengthen the governance of information pertinent to national security rather than introducing legislation that compromises our constitutionally mandated approach to access to information. If the state is leaking, then
stop the leaks. Don't set up a new information regime, and that's what our national security apparatus should be concentrating on. Not on bolting the door after the secrets have leaked out, but preventing the secrets from leaking out in the first place. And then let me turn finally and briefly to the whole question of the bill and whistleblowers. Many of you will have seen the report of Transparency, the recent report of Transparency International, which is entitled Daily Lies and Corruption, Public Opinion in Southern Africa. That report has been extensively cited for its evidence of increasing corruption in the 6 countries, including South Africa, that are surveyed. Public comment has highlighted the finding that the police service is the most corrupt institution identified by respondents in all 6 countries, and that is a finding, obviously, of direct pertinence to the bill before us. I'll just leave 5 more minutes to check this. However, we believe that another aspect of the survey results may have been overlooked. If you look at that survey, you'll see that 76% of the people surveyed believe that ordinary people can make a difference in the fight against corruption. In South Africa itself, 80% of those expressed confidence in the ability of ordinary people to contribute to combating corruption. However, when the survey respondents were asked if they would report an incident of corruption, only 60% of South Africans responded affirmatively, against a regional average of 77%. The willingness of South Africans to report an incident of corruption is at the lowest of all the countries surveyed, including Zimbabwe. So what do we make of this data? Are South Africans insufficiently concerned with corruption to bother reporting it? The answer to that is clearly no, because this is flatly contradicted by other data in the report. Are South Africans skeptical of the ability of ordinary people to make a difference? No, because this too is not borne out by the data that I've just referred to. So a likely conclusion is that South Africans are fearful of the consequence of reporting incidents of corruption and do not trust the institutions of state tasked with combating corruption. And regrettably, this conclusion is borne out by our own short-lived experience. Because while we've received many reports of corruption, many of those reporting have declined to identify themselves. On our social media platforms, and on many encounters with the public, both on radio call-in programs and through our stakeholder outreach program, many members of the public have openly articulated their fear of reporting corruption. This response is particularly strong from small towns, where the risk of exposure to powerful and vengeful local political bosses and corrupt business leaders is particularly high. The ineluctable, albeit extremely distressing conclusion is that many people living in South Africa are afraid of their governments. In particular, as already suggested, local governments in areas out of media focus and out of the public eye. The fear is of victimization in their workplaces, fear of being placed on an unofficial supplier blacklist, fear of being selectively denied access to public goods and services like housing, and fear for their lives. We all know the stories about Moss Parkway and others who've given their lives fighting for a corruption-free South Africa. So the fear of people, in other words, is of unofficial sanctions for reporting corruption. We are not suggesting that these are sanctions that are supported by the state or by government. However, the bill and its possible passage into law has added another dimension to their fear. A fear of formal and harshly punitive sanction at the hands of the state. We are not imagining this. Scores of people communicating with us have asked how we expect to continue to function when the bill is passed into law. Scores of people have asked us how we can responsibly ask them to reveal their knowledge of corruption when they may bring the wrath of the state down on them in the form of the sanctions contained in the bill. The inevitable response by supporters of the bill is that these people are misled, even if their conclusions have been distorted and their fears exaggerated by the robust campaign against the bill. However, what is undoubtedly clear is that this perception is right and it is likely to intensify once the bill is passed. This, in the face of already weak whistleblower protection,
will be a severe blow to combating corruption, so severe as to lend credence to the view that suppressing information is one of the implicit intentions of the bill. We have no doubt that if the bill is passed, NGOs like ourselves will begin strategizing how to continue our work in a new context, surrounded as we are by clever lawyers and sympathetic lawyers, and by a robust and vigilant media whose own work is seriously threatened by the bill. We may find, and I think we undoubtedly will find, the shortcomings of the legislation, beginning no doubt with a constitutional challenge to the bill. These naturally all add risk and cost to the business of fighting corruption, but we will probably find ways of prevailing and continuing our work as we did in the face of more hostile national security-based legislation in previous years. However, this will be cold comfort to those living throughout South Africa, particularly in rural and other marginalized areas who do not have access to publicity and legal support in their struggles against corruption. It's not difficult to envisage a corrupt manager of a small rural town or a corrupt business person in that setting waving a copy of the newly minted Protection of Information Act at those who would expose them and warning them of the possibility of long prison sentences that they will get as thanks for their efforts. This doesn't have to be true. It simply has to be believed. And without the legal triumph and other backing to advise them to the contrary, prudence will invariably triumph over valor, over courage in this regard. And if that does happen, it will be the most downtrodden South Africans, those most severely disadvantaged by corruption, that will be denied voice. And I think that this legislature will hesitate to impose this price on South Africa, and on those South Africans in particular. So in conclusion then, we strongly endorse the views of the MRC on the constitutionality of the intended legislation, as we do ODAC's arguments regarding the impact the bill, if passed, would have on whistleblowing and its essential incompatibility with FIRE and the Protected Disclosures Act. Our recommendations, as I've said, recommendations at a very high level. Our preferred recommendation is drop the bill altogether and expand exemptions in FIRE to include information threatening our national security, rather than introduce parallel legislation in the form of this bill, and strengthen the governance of information pertinent to national security, rather than introducing legislation that compromises our constitutionally mandated approach to access to information. If that is not to be the preferred path of the legislature, we would propose firstly that the bill be renamed the Protection of State Information that Pertains to National Security. This is not just a token gesture, it's a way of telling people that this is the only area in which information is restricted, and it also is another authority when the court comes to interpret whether information should be restricted. Secondly, specifically exempt any information that could lead to criminal prosecution of the corrupt from its definition of classified information. Thirdly, support a public service campaign to encourage members of the public to report information pertaining to corruption, advise them where to report this information, and assure them that the provisions of the legislation will not be used against anyone who reports corruption. So thank you, Chairperson, for the invitation to be here and the opportunity to address your committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. Honourable President Zimani.
Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Member.
The presenter repeatedly said that they do believe that in the importance of security and of some secrecy in relation to security checks, and then he mentioned examples around the complaints with regards to SATS and the defense, and even the report that they are going to release on Metropolis. Now, the clarity that I in this regard, because it's proposing for a central, recommending the title change, and I think it relates to the question I raised with the Law Society of South Africa, the issue of valuable information. If the Corruption Watch do understand the two categories of valuable information, and are they properly balanced in terms of this bill, so that we get that clarification. Secondly, Chair, Section 11C of the bill refers to a register of classified information. Now, he's also been repetitively emphasizing the issue of the PAIA and being compromised, and this bill's objects or objectives to be a default regime of the compared to what is intended with the Promotion of Access to Information Act. So now, is that clause, in terms of his understanding of that clause, that sets out the register of the information that is classified, how does it, is there, in his view, how does it affect that? And with that, Chair, there's also a clause in the Constitution that says the head of state organ would have to annually present reports which would be even referred to Parliament as public scrutiny. I mean, for public scrutiny and even for Parliament oversight and accountability of those heads of state in terms of the activities on these matters of classification of information or protection of valuable information. So, is a feeling that those provisions in the bill are not far-reaching, and perhaps do they need to be strengthened? Because he's proposing, I think, if you conclude on your own, Chair, you might say that he says that this bill is unnecessary. The other thing, Chair, is also to there is a constitutional responsibility on security agencies, and he seems to have repeatedly emphasized that in their assessment of security, that the country is not imminent. No, there is no imminent security, and so is that the view, that in terms of this bill, issues of espionage and all that must be dropped, or what is he trying to say in terms of what the bill seeks to do, and his or the Corruption Watch's assessment of the work. I mean, of the security risks of the country. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think in the end of the presentation, we are sort of getting the proposal from Corruption Watch, basically they're saying, let's only deal with matters pertaining to national security in the main. That's what they're saying. And I concur with Honorable Zimande that it seems that the presentation seems to say to us there's no need for
for this bill. But Chairperson, you know, my difficulty with the presentation was, you know, throughout was the separation of the real objects of the deal. Because I thought since morning and we are making progress in so far as very clear proposals that are being made to the ministers. But this presentation has basically clouded or been clouded by the credibility issues throughout that have been raised from people who are working for government, and this is the area perhaps that concerns me most, because we think, and the people have spoken on the preference of government general, and here you get a presentation that is totally pessimistic about this country, about state organs, completely not trusting them. And this is the area perhaps I want Corruption Watch to comment on. Because like I say, the people have spoken through various means about the preference of government in this country, and we believe we are attempting to really deal with corruption head on, and you can look at the cases that have been unearthed so far, although some people claim that they're the ones responsible for that kind of unearthing of corruption. But Jefferson, my worry is really this negative, completely negative perception about the state organs, about ourselves, and I would like to hear him commenting about that. To me, it's not fair. It's completely unfair on us to get this kind of comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chef. And thank you very much for Corruption Watch for this straightforward presentation. I'm going to ask one question, and that's on nine, your point nine, on police. You mentioned a lot of issues there about complaints and so on of corruption and what. Now, my question, straightforward question and a short question. Are you saying as Corruption Watch that passing this bill in its present form, we are going to see more problems and a cover-up on this type of reporting? Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much, honorable member. You know, I don't know really how we're going to deal with this, because if you remember Corruption Watch when we started, or before even we started their presentation, they made the point that their submission is going to be very generic. It will just be based on general comments. They do not have the luxury of having followed the act, and as a result, they would not be able to speak to specific areas that need specific approaches or improvement in terms of the bill as it stands at the moment. So I thought maybe with that statement, it was to say, you will forgive us if we are unable to really point at certain sections where we think certain improvements will have to be made, and rather the philosophic and general approach to should appeal. as members, I thought maybe we would accept and take note of the issues that they raised and allow ourselves as a committee to look at really where in the Act do we think if it is not strengthened, it would then confirm the fear that corruption watches in areas that would perpetuate and corruption and let it just happen as if there are no systems in the country to deal with corruption. But I'm not saying this to limit or to deny Corruption Watch an opportunity to respond or to comment on some of the issues that have been raised, if so wish. But I just thought that we should make the point so that we shouldn't expect direct responses to specific things. Because the presentation is very broad, it's generic, it speaks to a whole range of issues. And to me, it is like a caution to the committee as we proceed with the bill, and especially the conclusion, where it says it 100% do not agree with the bill to a point where they even make a proposal of the name changing or the title changing, if not the absolute rejection of the bill. It sounds radical, but it comes from an organization that is vested. You can have a sea of a frustrated organization of corruption, and I think that's how we all are. That should be our attitude towards corruption, all of us. We need to be angry with corruption. Don't have to be sleeping in bed or to be in bed with corruption. You need to be out there, campaigning as activists against corruption. I'm avoiding to go into the Act because there is an honest observation that was made from the beginning. But if you still feel strongly that there are certain things that you would want to respond to, I would allow you, but also caution that we don't go back to the generic issues, you know. As the general comment as well made.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be very brief. Thank you. You did provide a better representation of my views and my answers than I probably could by myself, but I will answer some of them very briefly. We're certainly not saying that there are no systems to deal with corruption in this country, but that it's common cause in the law enforcement agencies, in the executive leadership of the country, that the public has to be involved in the fight against corruption. And the only way that the public can be involved in the fight against corruption is by being given the right to be informed and to inform. And that's why the Information Bill is any bill dealing with information and with public information about the doings of the state are central to our concerns, because it's the only weapon that we have. We don't have the weapon and the powers or the resources of the police. The public don't have those resources. And so they have knowledge and they have information. And if that knowledge and information is denied them, their ability to fight corruption is significantly curtailed. On the other question about whether we think that there should be a bill at all or not, to be perfectly honest, I really think that PIO is capable of dealing with these issues if exemptions are expanded. And then what you have is a regime that defaults to access to information, but with certain exceptions, rather than a regime that restricts information, but that allows that information to be surface under certain limited conditions. And I think that's the spirit of the constitution, and it's the spirit of the country. So I think that PIA could be changed, and I think that the security apparatus, if they are worried about state secrets being leaked out, their time is better spent and their resources are better spent in plugging those leaks than in attempting to introduce a highly restrictive information regime. But I have no expectation that will be the outcome of what this committee is doing. So given that the outcome will be a law that imposes a restrictive regime on access to state information, then I have to say that I reiterate the proposals that we made here, and they're not made lightly, and they're not proposals that do not contain detail. We think that the bill should be renamed, and we think that that's in the spirit of the bill. The bill manifestly is intended to restrict information pertaining to state security, to national security. Why doesn't the title of the bill say that, so that we do not have an access to information regime on the one hand and a restriction of information regime on the other hand? This is about particular information, and it should say that. I think that the bill should exempt that from classification any information that could lead to criminal prosecution of the corrupt from its definition of classified information. That seems to me again to be in the spirit of the bill, and something that should be entertained, and that I believe could be entertained even at this stage. And the third proposal is in the form of an activist saying to you that people are worried about this bill, and they do not understand the details of its sufficiency possibly, but they are worried about this bill, and they are worried about what would await whistleblowers at the end of this bill. So what I'm saying is that the executive and Parliament is in a position to make these suggestions and to make these proposals, should be encouraged when this law is passed to support a public education campaign that actually tells people this bill is not about restricting information pertaining to corruption. It is only about restricting information pertaining to state security. And I don't think that that's an unreasonable request to make of the legislature, or for the legislature to make of the executive. There were a couple of detailed questions. I, to be perfectly honest, do not understand how the register of classified information will work. I mean, per definition, the register will not reveal the contents of what it is that is classified. So it will be at a very high level that register is presented and publicized. And I'm not certain how informative it will be, or how revealing it will be of what it is that is actually classified. You may be able to tell me differently, but I think it will be a very high-level register, a very high-level classification that is given. Must issues of espionage be dropped, one of the members asked? No, I don't think that it should be, and I think that there is a need to protect state security in the narrowly defined sense of state security. But I do contend, and I think a few people would disagree with me, that the imminent threats that we face are not from armed insurrection, either inside the country or from armed forces who are threatening us from outside the country. The threat to our national security as broadly defined, I think there are very few people, including the leaders of government in this country, who would disagree, come principally from inequality, from poverty, from unemployment, and from the contribution that corruption makes to all of those social ills. And, you know, finally to say, if Corruption Watch and the people who work for it were pessimistic about the state, we would really not be doing, about state organs, we would not be doing what we're doing. Thank you.
No, thank you very much for the presentation. I don't know whether I should make this remark, but you know, sometimes it might just be a nice note. Nobody thought there will ever be a 9/11 event taking place in America. I'm very confident that the most protected, they were very powerful. But it happened. It has happened in Africa. So whether if we are faced with imminent threat or not, even if we know or we don't know, I think we shouldn't make that statement. Of course, it is not for this committee to determine whether if we are faced with those threats or not. But to say we are not, it's very dangerous. Equally so to say we are not, it's also equally dangerous. So, you know, complacency sometimes when it comes to matters of instability, particularly in countries, it can be, it can work against a country and so forth. So, I would rather just say, let's look at what is best for us as South Africa, than to be too comfortable on what we have, our system, our democracy working, all those sorts of things. But you take the point. And rest assured, I think these members, these honorable members would not have been here to listen to Corruption Watch if they were not committed to fighting corruption. They will definitely afford themselves an opportunity to look at the case, taking into account what Corruption Watch is saying, and look at what are the areas that need to be strengthened within the bill to fight corruption. So they are here, they have listened to you, they have listened to everybody during the day. It has been a long day for members. Tomorrow is going to be another one. Thursday is going to be another one, and Friday. So let us release members for now and encourage to go and prepare for tomorrow and hear how things go out without allowing any debate. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.